Welcome to the TFT podcast. I'm Matt. That's Ryan. Ryan, don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
Hey, listen, one way or another, I'm going to find you. I'm going to get you.
This week, we are talking about Blondie's Parallel Lines. We had an alternative. This is actually the point where we were so good, Ryan. We had a Google spreadsheet and everything. Where
Blondie's in the spreadsheet, just in a different tab.
in the potential tab. We were so good. We had plotted out this entire quarter's worth of TFT historical retrospectives in order to tell a coherent story. But then as we were going and as our conversation progressed, it turned out the story that we wanted to tell was different than the story that we initially wanted to tell. This kind of thing would be like a firing offense in an actual school, right? Because, you know, the students have all bought these non-refundable textbooks. Right, they've dropped like $400 on the required reading for the course, and another $200 if they bought the recommended reading.
Right,
and you just can't change courses like that. Fortunately, the advent of Spotify means that we can do whatever we want. But we want to give you a warning as you pause this podcast now and go listen. It's fucked up on Spotify. There, it's like a special edition, or they can't license all of the songs, or some chicanery and tomfoolery with the Spotify version of this song. So we encourage you to use the affiliate link to Amazon to buy the MP3 downloads or a physical copy of this record, or if you get it on the waffles.
Or I was going to say, or go to your local record store and get a used copy, because I'm sure they abound. If you actually have a turntable or a cassette player, head out. Help out your local business. I mean, help us out through a affiliate link. But if you're going to just steal it anyway, then go to a local record store.
For God's sake, give them $2 or $3. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Give back once in a while.
I was in an Urban Outfitters, and do they all have little like vinyl record sections?
Yeah, I think they do now.
Over mm-hmm. in the corner. This was in the huge tourist destination, Santa Monica, 3rd Street Promenade. So it was, like, it's a mega Urban Outfit. It's like a Costco sized Urban Outfitters. Right. And it's, you know what I found? The two finds, there, I mean, cause they have all kinds of bullshit that's old. Right, classics and, you know, indie classics and punk and stuff like that. But I found two records. I found The Bones of What You Believe, which I almost bought. It was hard to keep myself from buying it, but I didn't want to give Urban Outfitters my money and figured I could support Chiverches another way. Right next to Bright Eyes, I'm Wide Awake, It's Morning. Huh. And that, like, that double header would be a, is right up my alley, those two.
Yeah, it's a mashup album waiting to happen.
I'm Wide Awake. It's The Bones of What You Believe.
Yeah, exactly.
Or The Bones of Mourning. I don't know. But, okay, so go listen to Blondie now. It's fun. It's short. You're going to enjoy it. Listen to Parallel Lines. And we'll be back right after this message from our sponsor.
Are you hanging on that telephone?
My feet are barely touching the ground. I'm flailing here. Help me.
Cordless telephones. They set you free to follow the one that you love.
That's a commercial that's appropriate to the era that the album is from.
Right? Look at this amazing. Well, it's a little early. I mean, I think that's actually really interesting because I feel like, I mean, the problem of having a telephone with cord is appropriate to the era, as this is a time before the phones were set free. But the solution of cordless telephones, it's interesting that you say that it's appropriate to the era, because, you know, this is an album we didn't fast forward in time, right? Parallel Lines is from 1978. So it's
That's a
continuing.
Good point. And I guess the heyday of cordless phones was what, the late 80s.
Right. But I think that this is actually something that it's as good of a place of any to start, that there's a temptation. I think that both of us were surprised that Blondie in general and Parallel Lines in particular was hitting the chronology where it is. That is right here in this late 70s, as opposed to the early or mid 80s.
Right. I think of new wave music as being exactly. like a 1980s phenomenon. Right.
Right.
And not being something that's contemporaneous with all the like the seminal punk records that we've been looking at and some of the post-punk, also. And we should probably, but we're going to stick a pin in the genre classification, but we got to get to it. But did you have the same impression that I had about being sort of brought up short, that this is in a way like very forward looking, really ahead of its time?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think that there's a few different ways to go from here, but I think it just is surprising. I mean, I knew that Blondie's initial output, they were a band that straddled the 70s and the 80s, but I had not quite been aware that this album. I kind of assumed that this album, as one of their big kind of crossovers, and including some of their most memorable songs, you know, a couple of which we've referenced, and especially "Heart of Glass," which was the song that really put them over the top as a pop sensation. That I assumed that this was kind of, you know, actually in the 80s. In part just because it's, you know, like you say, of the genre association and some elements of the general sound, and me just not distinguishing these singles from some of Blondie's other hits, like "Call Me" or "Atomic," which I believe are a bit later, or either another year later in the 70s, or are actually out in the 80s. But I think that I think this point of new wave happening a lot sooner than what we suspect, that there's in fact the new wave that one associates with the 80s is actually old wave already. So I think there's a lot of different questions, but I think maybe the first one to start with is in the, you know, and we did this a bit when we were starting with punk with the Ramones, but what does it mean to be new wave? Just based on this context of Blondie, and we're going to, in coming weeks, talk about a few other bands that are kind of under this heading of new wave. But just based on experiencing this album, Parallel Lines, what does new wave seem to mean, or what seem to be the characteristics, or is it not a very useful descriptor?
Well, I think of it like electronica. Do you remember that from the late 90s, early 2000s, right? It's a marketing term that's,
or grunge in that way. Then.
Sure, absolutely, right? Like that is used to yoke together a lot of music that is actually pretty heterogeneous, right? When you consider their characteristics the characteristics of the different music in itself, with grunge, I mean, is maybe the example I'm most familiar with. Like there's a big difference between Pearl Jam and Soundgarden. Those are two really, really different bands. And, the fact that they kind of, I don't know, come out of the same scene or something like that, or Nirvana, or what have you.
Alice in Chains.
Yeah. Jane's Addiction, right? Like you may as well be in five different universes, and it's sort of a marketing thing, right? Like the marketing for cultural products is supposed to create demand for the latest cultural products, or else we'd just be spinning Dichter Liebe all the time. And there wouldn't be any need for these new, you know, sorrows of young Werther. So I look at it. I mean, my eye is somewhat jaundiced when I look at the term, when I hear the term new wave, but I associate it with some of the, like the, I associate it with 80s synth pop, honestly. Right. And what strikes me in listening to this is that this record has kind of roots that stretch into the past and into the future,
which is
interesting to me, right? Like, and on the Wikipedia page, and we'll link up all the usual things in the show notes, on the Wikipedia page, you can see that it is, classified as bubblegum pop, and I think that's apt, right? And it this goes back to like brill building pop. Mm-hmm. This goes back to like my boyfriend's back and you're going to be in trouble, you know, hey la, my boyfriend's back. It goes back to all of that kind of catchy, very hooky, female fronted pop music that my mom listens to on the oldies station. My mom has two modes, oldies station and country station. And when she's in oldies station mode, it's all this, it's my party and I'll cry if I want to, right. that kind of stuff. So the fact that it goes back to that, and like the amount of stuff that it's going, you know, the amount of stuff that's going on at the same time, right? You have the Ramones and Sex Pistols, right? More art punk,
Television and Talking Heads that we'll get to in a few weeks, if not next week.
You have the Runaways, who have released three or four or maybe all four albums by this point. Just for a comparison of a female fronted group, but you know, as I was listening to this, who kept popping up in my mind?
And
not just because you IM'd me a link to a video. Before that, I swear, our friend Jenny Humphrey, Little Jay.
Taylor Momsen. Debbie Harry. Yeah, Debbie Harry. Like especially on this Blondie photo on Wikipedia, is looking not unlike Little Jay, right? Early Little Jay, not like raccoon Little Jay.
With the blonde hair and the sort of the like beauty mark kind of thing, and the whole sort of throwback kind of glam throwback to Marilyn Monroe, though I guess it's not that much of a throwback at the time.
It's just a light toss backwards. Yeah.
It's recent history rather than like super, super nostalgia, right? Because, okay, so here's the comparison I was thinking about, right? You have this sort of, highly produced sound, right? Mm-hmm. In the context of a music, punk in the case of, punk in the case of Blondie, and maybe like hardcore in the case of the Pretty Reckless, you have kind of the most highly produced end of the spectrum that you can get, and still kind of be on the same spectrum as the main category that you're talking about.
Right.
You have a female fronted but completely male backed group, which sets it mm-hmm. apart from the Runaways, and you have this sense of kind of being throwbacks, right? Like
right.
The Pretty Reckless is to me kind of a throwback to more like hard rock, you know, Hail Satan kind of stuff that is kind of charming, actually, for how right. obsolete it is,
right.
you
right.
know?
And also, like, the kind of drinking hard, partying hard hair rock, right? There's both there's pieces of, like, the like rebellious rock and kind of like rebellion rock and kind of ne'er-do-well evil rock. Uh-huh. And there's like little pieces of that are kind of cobbled together and like put on a fake tattoo on Taylor Momsen's back.
Right.
Back and butt area.
and with Blondie, like the going back to the to the like the bubblegum pop, it sort of takes an evolution that the Ramones were taking, right?
Yeah.
And goes just a step further with it. I mean, it makes it just a little bit more palatable. And yet they were part of that CBGB scene from what Wikipedia tells me, right? Like
that they were kind of all in the mix.
In the mix together, you know?
Yeah, and I think there's a few pieces of this. I mean, I think what's interesting is, in addition to looking backward in that way, and I think you mentioned this, that it's also they're also looking forward, right? That that one thing that struck me when I went, and this is an album I've had on vinyl for a while, but had never really like given the, you know, spin after spin after spin that I do when I'm preparing for these episodes. And I think what struck me is, you know, having known the singles very well, they always jumped out at me more on my previous listens, but it's the you know, the deeper cuts, the album cuts, really, in addition to, like, that's where the kind of 50s, early 60s bubblegum pop sound is. But that's also, like, I feel like stretches forward to various revivals of that. I mean, it, like, I feel the connections to Tweens, or to Dum Dum Girls, or Best Coast, Vivian Girls, any number of kind of current post girl group bands that kind of come and go, and it gets various descriptors, whether it's like kind of garage, like neo garage girl group type groups. And it's striking how much that the many of the other songs on Parallel Lines that are not the singles really actually, so things like Just Go Away, the Buddy Holly cover I'm Gonna Love You Too, the I Know But I Don't Know, Pretty Baby, like a lot, even Picture This, which was a bit more of a single, but not quite at the stature of like Heart of Glass or One Way or Another, that these like really feel very, as much as they're a throwback, they also feel like contemporary indie rock in a really striking way. And I feel like that those stretches of the album are the stretches that really actually grabbed me this time around. 1159 is another one. That was probably actually on this listen emerged as my favorite song on the album. So I think that that kind of connection in both directions was really surprising, and I think that was and was kind of both contemporary and older in ways that were surprising to me.
Yeah, I agree. Let's see. I brought up Bright Eyes. I brought up Chvrches. Actually, Chvrches, right? Like, what are you looking for? What are you looking forward to? You're eventually looking forward to Churches, right? Like, mm-hmm. That's where this kind of synth pop thing is headed, you know?
Well, I think that's an interesting thing. I mean, let's talk about that. Like, let's talk about how the synthesizers are used here, mm-hmm. right? Because I think that it's... I mean, I think there's an interesting question. Is this synth pop or is this pop with a synth?
Huh.
And I think that I would venture to say that this is not yet synth pop.
Sure.
Because – and I think that – and this is the thing I was thinking about of how this is different from, you know – the newest new wave kind of differentiate from the older new wave or the more pop, you know, synth pop new wave of the 80s. And I think that there's a question of – I mean, I guess we'll try to think about what this conceptual space looks like, but I think there's a dimension that has to do with what the synthesizer is doing. Or I think that, and I'm trying to articulate this, like, I think that what's striking, or maybe to put it differently, what analog instruments are replaced by synthesizer? And again, I'm trying to think about what continuum makes sense, because there might be extremes where every analog instrument is replaced by synthesizer.
Uh-huh.
And that is like, I mean, like Chvrches. I guess Chvrches do play a guitar or bass from time to time, but there's a pretty far extreme end, or in terms of more historical things, like I mean, I think of like...
I don't know. I think of that. I'm looking at those. Maybe they do, but it's so... I mean, the guitar and the bass is so far abstracted from the actual sound that is removed at the end. Like, I think of the canonical Chvrches performance being that, like...
Yep.
BBC one or something. You sent me it. I think it was a cover of... I forget exactly what they were covering, but it was a cover, and they were like hunched over. The two guys were hunched over their, you know, various like synthesizers, arpeggiators, laptops, what have
you. Yep.
And the singer, oh, forgive me, I can't remember her name, but she was like, her eyes were downcast looking at a lyric sheet. And it was this like very intensely, almost introspective, right? Like almost meditative, kind of very introverted way of making music as opposed to, you know, as opposed to performance.
Right. Lauren Mayberry.
Yeah. Lauren Mayberry. Right. There you go.
Right. And so, but so that's like a end, and some of, and you know, we're not going to get to the 80s on this historical stretch, but some other bands of the 80s, you know, also, even if there were, don't have that set up, you know, had, you know, there were electronic drum kits, guitars, that many of the shapes of the, of a rock band were, if not fully replaced by synthesizers, were replaced by instruments that were not analog. Right, it was the beginning of the digital world.
Right,
and I think
a big turning point is the release of the Roland TR-808 drum machine in 1980.
Right. And so here we're still a ways off from that. So you do have, and I actually don't know if it says.
I guess we're 2 years off from that. I guess that is forever in scene time, right?
Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, the way that these micro variations are churning, and just sonically, we're a way off from that.
That's true.
From
Madonna, I think of its apotheosis in the 80s being in Madonna, which is this like very highly manufactured seeming pop music, you know?
Sure. And so I think, and so there are keyboards here, right? There are there are synthesizers, but I think that they, I mean, what is your impression of what the keyboard parts are doing on this album?
Well, like
what?
Not, yeah, they're not replacing the rock band. I mean, one way to think about a band or an orchestra or anything is to like to break it down into function, right?
There's right, like exactly.
There's like a propulsive rhythm function.
Yep. Yep.
There's a like usually a bass function, which is to sort of establish the root of the harmonies. Mm-hmm. Then there's like various kinds of decorative functions. By guitar, which does both kind of rhythmic propulsion and harmony, melody, counter melody, you know, in pop music, sort of hook, right? Like all that stuff. And the synths, I mean, in this record, it seems to me the synths give a lot of the hooks, that 7/4, hooky thing in Heart of Glass.
Right.
I think that main melody to that hook is being played on the synth. And you know, and stuff like stuff. So it's not, I mean, it's right that the people have not yet begun to be replaced by robots. You know,
right.
we're not at the level of Kraftwerk or something like that, or you know, like
right, which is contemporaneous with this, or even a little before it. But the Kraftwerk has not, you know, the Kraut rocket that we talked about last week with David Bowie has not yet. It's been launched, but it has not yet exploded.
Well, we've talked about like technological avant-garde art music that seems to belong more to classical, though it's not classical, you know, as a classical music scholar would understand it, but that belongs to the world of the university and the concert hall. Like we've talked about various aspects of that, and there is a whole kind of bunch of technological innovation going on in that sphere, and you know, companies like Roland package it up and make it available to popular music. And, you know, I don't know, one of the stories that we're telling is the story of that technology coming to fruition in a sort of mass market attainable way, so that you don't have to be at a university or whatever to get this sort of to get access to things like audio synthesis.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and I think that as we see, I will be interested to track this and kind of test and build that theory as we as we go on, and I think that as a result, you know, that there are then experiments in what can be replaced and what the effects of that are. I think the other thing that's going on with a lot of the keyboard lines and keyboard sounds that are being used, especially on the more on the album cuts and the songs that are more throwback feeling is that the I feel like what the what I hear the synthesizers doing is producing the kind of replacing the orchestral ornamentation that was there in a lot of the kind of Phil Spector-esque wall of sound pop, right? Sure. So and that was brought back again and again in some of our Phil Spector referencing things that we've discussed, right? So that in our in Pet Sounds, in Springsteen, and even in the kind of poor man's Phil Spector that was you know that the Velvet Underground was building, right? Their I think I said their wall of sound, you know, had barbed wire on top. And so so this wall of sound is like a shimmering force field, huh. Right? And what I mean there is that I feel like a lot of these things that are kind of this, you know, some of this, whether it's ornamentation or the kind of sonic richness, is filled out by synthesizer, and it's kind of playing that role. And I feel like that's actually a really kind of, you know, important.
Right.
And let
me jump in here. Right. Like what's happening. Because it's important to kind of figure out what's happening to the wall of sound, right? Like Springsteen built, I guess that's coming, but the Springsteen wall of sound, the Phil Spector wall of sound, the Velvet Underground wall of sound, whatever the personality of it, they are brick walls of sound or stone right. walls of sound, right? They're laid piece by piece, and you can think of the spectrum, you can think of a spectrum, right? Frequency, of audio frequency, low, you know, mid-range, high, little niches, and he sort of lays bricks into those little right. niches. Like one is the piano occupying the sort of the high end of the thing. One is for Phil Spector. A lot of it is orchestral, which can like run the gamut of frequencies. With Blondie, and with a lot of the synthesized wall of sounds, it's a poured concrete wall of sound because you are electronically filling in at sort of even amplitude, right? The whole range of the, you know, audible sonic, frequencies, you know, and the synthesizer, the, you know, square wave patch or what, you know, what have you, just occupies space and can be programmed to occupy an arbitrary amount of space so that you don't have to go out. You sort of become less a bricolure of sound and more like a Robert Moses of sound, less a Jane Jacobs of sound and more a Robert Moses of sound, right?
Right.
Because you are building Lincoln Center, you know, you're doing this like, or you're building like the World Trade Center site, right? You're doing this giant bathtub of a whole block construction with no access to the street and no real reference to the kind of street level life.
You're building sonic housing projects.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, that's what the synthesized wall of sound, that's what kind of filling out the spectrum with audio synthesis gets you.
That's really fascinating. And it's really amazing to see how much that takes over the mainstream of music production in throughout the 80s and even as like the default setting throughout the 90s. And I think it's really striking to kind of think about how strongly this is permeated and then circles back. Is I actually really remember early on in the Arcade Fire's career, when I was trying to explain the Arcade Fire to a friend and what they sounded like, I actually said, well, it's like new wave music, but instead of synthesizers, there's orchestral instruments. and what's really interesting is that you would say just the opposite of Blondie at that time, right? Is that it is like Phil Spector pop, but with synthesizers instead of the orchestral instruments. So it's interesting how these things cycle and what is the kind of rebellious and kind of avant-garde or new wave leading edge to ride kind of you know, oscillates based on what is mainstream, right? So that, you know, the amazing, it is really interesting that what was, you know, for the Arcade Fire kind of getting active in early 2000s, Montreal, I guess, was to, you know, actually hiring these, you know, orchestral musicians and bringing them and kind of playing with the vigor and aesthetic and types of clubs of a punk band, right? Bringing this big thing that, you know, had lived in the studios and the universities and the concert halls and bringing that, to the stage was this radical act. And I think that in this similar way, I think that kind of contextualizes the way in which Blondie does fit in with the CBGB scene and the downtown scene and, you know, the loosely affiliated world of punk, and also why they don't fit in, right? That on the one hand, there, I think that act of like, say, well, we're playing this girl group pop, but we're writing our own songs and we're making it ourselves. We don't need this studio time because we have this synthesizer and that itself, I think caught on to an extent that it doesn't feel radical and it feels, and you know, in fact, they got very popular. So it feels as if it was inevitable. And that is, well, they were just a pop band, but they took this thing that was not particularly mainstream or normal at the time. Especially the first couple of Blondie albums were much, you know, lower production value, rougher around the edges. But you know, the fact that, you know, again, the fact that you are writing these songs that are homages or deconstructions of kind of bubblegum pop songs, at a certain point they only stay so rough and you get better producers. You know, that Parallel Lines is this really interesting transitional album where there's those elements of that kind of, you know, that punk danger, but more and more of that sheen of pop, where it's, you know, the sounding good and sounding like a kind of brill building pop is less of a confrontational statement and a more of a thing that may get people to buy records. Right. It's again, it's like that. My all time favorite Onion article, which I think I've referenced on here. And if not, I'm sure someone else has on other Overthinking properties. But it's the Overthinking article that's titled something to the effect of ironic porn purchase leads to unironic ejaculation.
Yeah, sure. And speaking of which, I was you sent me on a Vivo kick of watching Pretty Reckless videos again, and the video for Fucked Up World, which was released I think in the last month, has I don't know, it's an interesting video in that the whole thing is done like kind of surf pop aesthetic, right? Like girls in bikinis on the beach, like very right. Brightly lit daytime thing. I don't know if you've seen this video.
I've not seen it. No,
but it's you know, and they're, you know, there with their wagon with their surfboards, you know, strapped to it and stuff. And then they splash around in the water and Taylor Momsen spanks the model's ass or something like that. But then it's cut away to this sort of incongruous scene of two women in like gold body paint making out on a pile of money. And like, there are these like, they're supposed to be like little tantalizing cutaways to this. And they're, you know, they're wearing, they're stripped down to their underwear and you can see their boobs and stuff. And like, they're making out on this pile of money. And then at the very end, they hold up they look accusingly at the camera after this, like, you know, rising action of because it started off pretty intense and it was like, wow, how is this going to pay, right? Like, how are they going to make this payoff? And the payoff, as it like gains in intensity and of like the provocative nature of their posing and writhing and stuff like this, and where there are a couple of like full on crotch shots of these women. And then at the end, the money shot is that they both look accusingly at the camera and hold up a sign, like a piece of like, you know, poster board on which is handwritten, "Is this what you want to see? Is this what you want to see?" And my answer is, well, yes, right? Because it's like, it's been what you've been showing me for the last 4 minutes, right? Like, I refuse to feel bad because you've made some unironic porn in the name of irony, you know, some unironic Skinamax in the name of, right, like making me feel bad, right? And you you don't. You know, I don't know. The handwritten sign is not a fig leaf over your enterprise. You know,
no. I'm so sure that those actresses just actually seized the means of production. They actually snuck that in there, and no one actually knows that it's there. It's this like bold thing that they really pulled on the Pretty Reckless, on the record label.
They're getting one over on Taylor Momsen, that's for sure.
No, but I think that is interesting. I mean, this idea of kind of subversion and co-optation is really interesting with respect to this album, because it does, I mean, it is interesting of, you know, in the context of Blondie and the context of Parallel Lines, it does like feel a bit like, you know, what is I think appealing or interesting here is like there's a bit of a seizing of the means of pop production, uh-huh, right? That and so that, and rather than you seize these means, you know you're writing songs, you're embracing a little bit of this anyone can write these songs, that, you know, their model of pop revolution is not to build a totally new society, a new pop society, you know, reimagine or deconstruct pop or abolish it, destroy it, in the way of you know, especially kind of the Sex Pistols, and even them, you know, they're not the most, you know, fringy side of that. But that rather they just kind of rerun the pop society, you know, the pop dictatorship with them at top. They just install new people, right? And they are kind of trying to keep making the pop, but it's going to be different this time because we are of the people, right? We are not Carole King, right? We are not these distant professional people, and so we're going to do it differently. And I think that that's what's kind of interesting. And I think this is Parallel Lines is a fascinating document of that. I mean, so I guess here's like an interesting question of, you know, do they do it differently, and if so, how? Like, how is this? What is, you know, as we kind of drill down into the songs themselves, in what ways does this function as a pop album, and in what ways does this function as a kind of a protest or rebellious album, and where are the kind of interesting points or tensions there, like what's, you know, how, in what ways is this working as something that's, you know, dovetailing with, you know, our broader story?
A lot of it for me was in the lyric writing, was in mm-hmm. the kind of is in kind of a feminist reading of the lyric writing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's for me where a lot of the kind of subversive force of this album is generated, rather than being something that's sort of musically transgressive, though I guess there is that hook in Seven, but
but I would argue that even just pairing like some amount of you know, of pairing deliberately pairing feminism with the girl group musicals is itself, so it's not even like, so I would argue that I agree just the music itself doesn't feel radical, but also then the music and as it interacts with the lyrical content then kind of elevates the kind of critique or the what's kind of subversive about it.
Sure. I don't know, you go too far into that and you become Lana Del Rey, I guess, but
here be Lana Del Rey dragons, right? Like, fall off the edge of the earth. Yeah.
Exactly, and Lana Del Rey is waiting to eat you up. You know, so like I don't know, some of the stuff, like it's picture this is one, that kind of reverses the paradigm of this, of the woman, you know, of the kind of woman as object or the woman as entertainment, which is particularly poignant this week in the wake of the celebrity photo hacking.
I was thinking exactly of that as well. It felt really. It's amazing that we both, without talking about that, had that resonance. Because especially right, all I want is a room with a view, a sight worth seeing, a vision of you. I will give you my finest hour, the one I spent watching you shower.
Right.
All I want is a photo in my wallet, a small remembrance of something more solid. All I want is a picture of you.
Yep.
Poof.
Yeah. Right. So what's going on here? Right. I think like the role of the picture is something that's, the role of the picture is something that's interesting here. I actually had a offline email exchange with a person who wrote into the podcast email address at Overthinking It. And they were writing about the disappearing picture of Back to the Future, which is one of those like filmic moments that seems to just inspire so much overdetermined thinking and criticism, right? Because it doesn't work, and so we can sort of have fun bending ourselves into all kinds of contortions, trying to make it work logically, trying to make the some kind of logical system reduced to an internally consistent set of rules in the universe of that movie. And I was just sort of riffing and ended up writing this like 1500 word disquisition on digital photographs.
As you do.
And because of course I did. And the thing that I came to is like, we think of digital photographs as being something that's more ephemeral, something that's less tangible, that's less reified than a physical photograph. But we have all this infrastructure of backups, infrastructure of kind of infinite digital reproducibility, infrastructure of like multiple redundant storage mechanisms.
That cloud lives somewhere.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And by the way, it's not just one. It doesn't just live in one place. It's right. Like the durability of it comes from its being kind of multiple redundant backups of any particular image. With respect to the celebrity photo hacking scandal, you strain the words, right? Because you sort of don't want to soft pedal at all. What a like a creepy
the celebrity photo hacking act of violence.
Yeah, the celebrity photo hacking. Yeah, exactly. Photo hacking crime. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Don't email me if you think this is awful and anti-feminist or whatever. Please don't email me. I don't care what you think. But
I love how like you can say that and say, you know what? But I'm going to say this anyhow.
but we also don't need to generate new circles of hell for this kind of thing. We actually have a theoretical framework that is adequate to dealing with what's happened, and it's of crime and criminality, right? Like we have mental models adequate to dealing with these things. It's just a question of like conceiving of it in the right terms, you know. The photo hacking. I forgot where I was. Oh, the one of the
picture,
unintended.
All I want is a picture of you.
Of the unintended consequences, I think, of this break-in, right? This hacking thing that happened is that people, I hope it doesn't make people reluctant to back things up in the cloud, to back up photographs in the cloud. Cause you see a lot of these very ill-informed editorials on these things. It's like, well, the only way to keep it safe is keep your photos out of the cloud, right? If you've ever dropped a phone down a toilet or in a lake, as I have, you know, and you don't have that backed up, like your precious memories of your newborn child are gone forever, right? Like you can't take it to the Apple store. The Apple genius is more a grief counselor than a technical advisor at that point, right? Like it's not good not to back up your digital information. But when you do, it becomes more durable than the physical thing, which is being a physical object is subject to physical forces, the ravages of time. We think of like colors fading on a photographic print as no big deal. Colors fading on a digital photograph, I mean, it's kind of an interesting sort of suggestive poetic idea, but it's not something that we'd accept because it doesn't happen. The color is a, you know, red, green, blue value, you know, in 64 bits or something like that, and it stays that precise value forever, you know?
Unless somebody comes in and has changed it, right? Like, the next wave of photo hacking is people coming in and putting Instagram filters on everybody's photos. They don't, you know, circulate them. They don't even look at them. They just put a blanket, just a blanket filter on all of them.
No, I mean, that exists. I mean, that's a thing that exists on the Chans and on Reddit and stuff like that, which is like putting, you know, celebrity heads on porn bodies, right? Like, and that's awful also. Maybe that is something that maybe we need a new theoretical framework for coping with why that is awful. Long digression, right? Like in all of these things that we're talking about, it's sort of like woman is photographed object, man as photographing subject, and picture this reverses those roles, which is interesting. But it keeps it really keeps the sort of creepiness, right? Like, the one I spent watching you shower. It's not entirely clear that this was a consensual watching you shower. You know what I mean? And
I think it's also kind of like harmonizing with like One Way or Another and Hanging on a Telephone. Uh-huh. You feel like it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. The photo, right? Like being in a concrete object that provides a room that is something more solid. That is a small remembrance of something more solid. That is to say, the moment is actually the durable thing, and the photograph is the ephemeral. Substitute. The other thing is in the last verse, right? Like 20/20 vision, a total portrait with no omissions, right?
Yeah.
I brought up Bright Eyes earlier, and his word, right, like, is truth that comes up again and again and again in his songwriting, which is like a direct, unmediated, no holds barred, nothing left out encounter with things as they are, right? Yeah. The sort of philosophically impossible and yet still simultaneously feared and longed for sort of consummation of knowledge that, you know, that is the subject of a lot of his songwriting, especially in relationships, right? As though you could kind of like, as though there were something other than the kind of layers of interaction and subjective experience.
Right. But to actually know the other person, to really know them.
A total portrait, with no omissions. That is like, that's an interesting, I mean, I don't know. That's an interesting thing. And then finally, I mean, because I guess I've been monopolizing too much about this song, like the framing, the anaphora, of all I want, all I want, all I want, all I want, right? There's almost a defensiveness to that. It's, I don't want much, comma, all I want is X. You know, that this is being posited as not an onerous requirement, you know.
It's just a picture. Just a picture, man. Just a picture.
All I want is this. It's not much to desire. Total knowledge of you, right? With no omissions, nothing left out, right? Is all I want. That's all I want.
And then, you know? I think what's really interesting, though, then is the title of the song and the other kind of parts of the chorus kind of flips the construction and takes the noun and turns into a verb, right? The picture this. And I find that I don't have a good read on what it's doing, but I think what's really interesting is that for me, what is coming after the picture this is are actually just are extraordinarily fragmentary, right? It's picture this. a day in December. Uh-huh. Picture this, freezing cold weather. You know, later on, picture this, a sky full of thunder. Uh-huh. Picture this, my telephone number.
Yeah.
Right? That when you are when you are picturing something, you're in fact using your memory, your own faculties to try to understand and engage with this and kind of, you know, recollect, even if it just happened, or, you know, go from experience to kind of desire, that it's kind of engaging this tension between, you know, this desire of this kind of technologically mediated kind of complete object and the incompleteness of one's kind of mental faculties of doing that. Mm-hmm. And I just love it. The way that it's sung and performed is just so it feels, I don't know if epic's the right word, but it would be awesome. I mean, I guess it's a kind of thing where, like, in the way that it's sung, I feel that in what I imagined CBGB's was like.
Uh-huh.
No, not the CBGB's that Mark and I visited,
uh-huh.
But the relevant CBGB's.
Sure. Yeah, but the CBGB's is always kind of a shared hallucination, right? Like, I was... like it's always you kind of always get into it what you put out of it, and if people agree if people agree that it's awesome, then it's awesome, you
right.
know, like
right.
if you put that it's true of so many things in life, like if you put that kind of energy into it, the kind of collective process of that can make it a thing. And that's also why scenes can become incestuous and self-regarding and sort of inbred, right?
Right, exactly. I think that's exactly right. What else? What did anything else jump out at you?
Let's talk about the telephone a little bit.
Yeah.
And hanging on it. Right. The as I was writing and taking notes, I sort of wrote, just because this is one of my bugbears. Right. I wrote technological mediation.
Uh-huh.
As a note, right? Like, and that,
and,
like,
and it connects really well, actually, to picture this, sure. Right? Uh-huh. Go ahead. Sorry, that was it.
Well, like, it telephone calls. I sort of remember. I remember being 13, right? Like being an effing teenager,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would like call my girlfriend after both of our parents had gone to bed, and we would talk for 6 hours at night. I don't know what the hell we had to talk about. I didn't have that many things in my head at the time, you know.
Right.
You know, so we would like just talk and talk on the telephone, and these things became events, right? Like, and you could sort of remember the telephone conversation and like talk about the telephone conversation that we had before and the night before or the week before or something like that. And I would have these like vivid memories of these things, and like they were very meaningful and they were very important. And the idea of like organizing your experience of a relationship around these technologically mediated events, a series of appointments, right, that are had through the telephone. And this is like pre-cell phone, this is pre-cordless phone, you know. In fact, it's like I'm in the phone booth is the first lyric of the song, you know.
Yeah.
It's like a special, you have to go inside the box to keep your appointment, you know? It's very weird. And it's one of those ways in which, it's one of those insidious ways in which technology can kind of, dominate our experience, can sort of, or force a certain kind of organization of our experience in a way that is transparent to us, but yet is really very, I don't know, really very authoritative, I guess.
Well, yeah, it forces you to be a stationary bandit of
right.
love.
Yeah.
Right? And so these days we are roving bandits of love.
Sure.
Right? We take it with us, but that you are, right, that it is, you know, one way to think of the telephone is as a ball and chain, right?
Uh-huh.
And that it is, you know, that you are by... I mean, it's kind of part of how I read Hanging on the Telephone is really almost being like shackled to it. And that, you know, the telephone is rooted to the wall and she is rooted to the telephone. And they're tied together through that, but also tied to that specific place. And I think that's really, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. The right, like there are three things that are necessary, right? Two of them are people and one of them is a device. And if you have two people and no device, no go. If you have one person and a device, but not the other person, no go. You know?
Right. Cause that's the hanging. That's when you're hanging on the telephone.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And that like you can't sort of penetrate through to the, you can't get through the veil, to the other person, you know. I don't know, but we're still like we're way the hell at the beginning of the album. Was do you want to dive into 1159 or something? If it was the one that you connected with a little bit before,
absolutely.
Before we hit an hour and wrap.
Sure. I think, I mean, there's a few things. Actually, I'd like to talk about 1159, and I'd also like to talk about Just Go Away.
Uh-huh.
I think were the two that that jumped out of me. And I don't know if I have, you know, concrete takes on these, but there's, I think, an 1159. I mean, there's a few things. All right. One is just, for me, this felt like the closest sonically to something that could live on like Born to Run. And I think that's both sonically and lyrically. Right. And so this idea about kind of right, take it down the highway like a rocket to the ocean, we can run. Right. I think it's definitely for me evokes some of the similar things, that we talked about, on Born to Run. And it kind of is, And is living in a similar space, and I think there's also these similar issues about wanting to stay alive and the kind of dire, you know, time is running out, and trying to find infinity in 1 minute, right? And that I think of harmonizes with some of what we talked about in Born to Run. I think we can dig in a little more to that. Look, I think I'm obligated to any time, like the first two lyrics are leaning in your corner like a candidate for wax.
Uh-huh.
Sidewalk social scientist, don't get no satisfaction from your cigarette.
Uh-huh.
And as a social scientist, anytime the words social scientist are spoken in a song, which is very rare, I'm obliged for it to become my favorite song because it's about me. This song's about me. This song might know that I exist. This song conceives of a world in which I am an element of that world. I'm not on anybody else's radar, but I'm on Debbie Harry's radar.
Yep.
And I exist. So beyond that, I mean, I think just this idea, how do you read, like this line and this song in general?
Leaning in your corner like a candidate for wax. I mean, candidate for wax. Well, so like couple ways. One is like wax. The obvious way I think is like wax figure. You know what I mean? That is to say, like striking a pose that is so iconic. And I think the idea of like sidewalk social scientist is like it's describing a person who's too cool for school, who's kind of slouching in the corner smoking a cigarette.
Do you know who is a sidewalk social scientist? Jane Jacobs.
Yeah, but she wasn't too cool for school.
No, it's true. She was just the right amount of cool for school.
the poses is iconic. I also wonder the like candidate for wax before records were pressed on vinyl. The original medium was wax and these like Edison wax cylinders.
Right.
So there is this kind of intimation of like candidate for wax being like candidate for a record deal. You know, a candidate for like pressing an album.
And so
like
these are the people that are kind of hanging out on the Bowery, right? These are the fixtures of the Bowery.
Sure.
And it's a different view of some. some of the pictures that are painted. I mean, I think especially kind of on the television record, but to an extent on the Ramones as well. But it's a very different view of that, because I feel like
They're slouching against their brick wall, like candidates for wax, right?
Right, exactly. And Debbie Harry's like, you want to get on a rocket to Russia? I'm calling bullshit. Here's the rocket. Are we going to Russia or what?
Yeah. So interesting, like next verse, right? Pumping like a fugitive in cover from the night. How do you pump like a fugitive, right? Take it down the highway like a bullet to the ocean. This is a person who's riding a bicycle.
Right.
You know, riding a bicycle down the road. This is
steampunk Springsteen, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, sir, baby, we were born to cycle, you know?
Right.
Punks like us, baby, we were born to cycle.
I think that that's really interesting. I mean, it harmonizes with the idea of kind of capturing the means of pop production, right? That you know, of course, it, like, rather than an orchestra, it's a synthesizer, and rather than a motorcycle, it's a bike.
Uh-huh.
A bike fugitive.
Which is funny because you've gone from the sort of old world artisanal to the new world mass produced in one movement, and mm-hmm. from the like American industrial mass produced and yet still a kind of a sign of originality, an assertion of originality like Springsteen's Suicide Machines, to a kind of twee, you know, twee hipster, like far less efficacious means of transport.
Right. There are precisely zero cc's of raw whining power.
Yeah. You've like in one sense, you've traded your letterpress for a Sharpie. And in another sense, you've traded your Sharpie for a, you know, I don't know, basket of feathers or something like that.
Right. No, exactly. And so I think it's really interesting, though, because I think that's exactly what I think is really appealing and really interesting about this song is that, you know, while some of the scale is different and is exactly kind of smaller scale and feels kind of smaller scale, and you know, the instrumentation is less bombastic and massive and huge than Springsteen, that it's sung in a similar way, right? And it is doing this a similar thing before of this kind of, you know, ironic Springsteen songs comes pretty close, right? And it has this sense of urgency and importance and epicness. You know, it's 11:59, and I want to stay alive, and it moves beyond being totally tongue in cheek of a kind of parody Springsteen song, and kind of crosses a threshold to kind of being an interesting kind of movement of that progression along. And I think it's part of what, and again, this was a song that I didn't know, that I didn't know as well, or it wasn't as salient before giving the album the deep listen. It actually is missing from the Spotify version. So again, if you didn't heed our instructions and you went to Spotify anyhow, you didn't get to listen to this awesome song. And so, you know, go to your record store.
Yeah, they leave you hanging on the Spotify.
Yeah, they do. They absolutely they leave you hanging. And so one way or another, you have to go and get this record.
Well, one way or another, we got to wrap up this podcast. But don't leave us hanging on the Twitters. You can follow us at TFT Podcast, where we have all kinds of talks about stuff pertaining to not just to the records that we're talking about, not just to the shows, but also to the whole TFT way of life. You know, I tweeted an Instagram of my new desktop wallpaper, which is I'll leave it to you to go find.
Yeah, exactly. If you tell them, they don't have to go to @TFT on Twitter. Yeah, that's TFT Podcast on Twitter.
That's a good point. And if you want to talk about Blondie, you can go to the comments. You know, no big deal if you don't. if you don't comment, we'll see you on Twitter. But if you want
to, we read them all. We read all the comments. We can't always respond to everyone.
You wouldn't want us to, but the
but we're there. We're reading them. They're forming part of the conversation, either internally or the conversation in our heads that we then project. It's all we've now really mastered the arts of technologically mediated relationships.
Yep.
And we're hanging on the comment threads.
Absolutely. Yeah. In last week's comment thread, or I guess 2 weeks ago as you listened to this episode, Mark Lee actually fills out a little story of your CBGB's anecdote that you told two episodes ago. That's something worth checking out, and great. We'll be back for more TFT next week. We'll post on Twitter what the syllabus is what it's going to be, so that you can get a little listening in over the weekend beforehand. Until then, as usual, whether it's a wall of bricks, a wall of poured concrete, or a shimmering force field, as long as you're listening to our wall of sound, it has been real.